Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Matt Trotter joins us today from San Francisco. Matt is the co-head of Stifel Venture Bank with a focus on providing commercial banking services to high-growth technology companies and private equity investors. Prior to Stifel, Matt has been in venture banking for over 18 years, with the majority of that time in leadership roles at Silicon Valley Bank, most recently leading the SVB Frontier Technology and Climate Technology groups across the U.S. Over that time, he has worked with thousands of venture-backed companies and provided over $10 billion in debt capital. Some notable companies he provided Series A financing for include Airbnb, Joby, Rocket Lab, Planet, and Affirm. And aligned well to this audience, he created a lending product specifically designed to support businesses selling in hardware as a service fashion that he deployed over $700 million in debt capital to that effort since 2017. And don't miss out on the report he co-authored, The State of Hardware as a Service, alongside Seth Winteroth at Eclipse Ventures. Well, Matt, this is a great way to kick off 2024 with a great banking ally to the digital industrial ecosystem. So thanks for joining and welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thanks for having me, Ty. Really excited to kick off the year. 2023 was a good year, but it was long. And we'll get into the reason why for me personally. But 2024, really, really excited about it. And thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Fresh calendar year. So let's get going here. I always give some version of a background here, but it's the cliff notes. So give us more of that color commentary on the journey and what led you to that current role now as the co-head of Stifel Venture Bank.
Yeah. So I'd say my initial entrance to venture banking was pretty random, kind of something I fell into kind of right out of college. But I would say my decision to stay in this profession has been very intentional. So two things that are always been true about me. One, I'm a generally curious person and I love to learn. And I'm also love to help people. So those are kind of what I you know, get passion and motivate me. And from a curiosity perspective, you know, I get to work alongside some of the smartest and most ambitious founders and investors. And I get a bird's eye view of these successes as well as the challenges as they go through different inflection points. And, you know, unlike kind of a venture capital investor who gets really deep with a handful of companies, you know, I get to go kind of less deep, but with a broader purview of kind of thousands of companies. And over that time, I've seen some incredible wins, some epic failures that we can share over beers, and all the things in between. And then just from a helping perspective, you know, at Silicon Valley Bank, and I'd say now at Stifel, we've always had this culture of focusing on adding value to founders as opposed to like near-term transactions. And I found that if you aggressively try to help people, you'll inherently be successful in the long term. And that's what keeps me motivated. And I feel like I still get to learn every day and still get to do that kind of work, which keeps me excited. So as I mentioned, kind of venture banking was quite linear. I started at the bottom as a credit analyst straight out of college, kind of fell into it. The only slight detour I had was when I was a few years into my venture banking career, I did leave banking to pursue a professional soccer career. I ended up playing professional soccer for a year down in Central America. It was an incredible experience, but there was like a moment of clarity I had when I was traveling to one game. We had to take a speedboat up a river through thick jungle, and then we had to be led by armed guards to the stadium. And at that moment, I realized that, you know, I might be better suited for venture banking. I'm a pretty soft individual. So that was a quick pivot back to the venture banking world. I would say my focus on deep tech came about 12 years ago when I was asked to take over the hardware team at the time. And you know, if you remember back to 10, 12 years ago in hardware, it was kind of a dreary kind of time. There was not much investment in like infrastructure, telco stuff anymore. Semiconductor wasn't nearly as popular as it was. And it was this mantra of kind of software eating the world. And so I took over a pretty small team that wasn't really growing. But lucky for me, pretty shortly after I joined, there started to be this kind of new crop of hardware companies and investors who were trying to leverage low-cost sensors and cameras plus advancements in artificial intelligence to bring technology to the physical world. And I will say I got very lucky where, you know, I just started to, you know, these are funds, you know, Eclipse and Lux and names that were just founded, that were getting off the ground, that I was kind of able to have kindred spirits with and say, let's look to kind of build a practice kind of around this new thesis. And at the time, there wasn't many commercial bankers that were focusing on that space. Also, I found that these companies needed a lot of capital, debt capital, to grow. And so I was able to kind of build that practice from pretty small. We built it to a point where we're doing several billions of loans every year. When I left, we had about 30 billion plus in deposits and ended up being a pretty big kind of practice at the bank. And that was at Silicon Valley Bank. Then if you get into terms of kind of how I ended up at Stifel, so I was at Silicon Valley Bank during the March 2023 bank run. That was my comment of 2023. Was a long year. For all of us that were there, kind of completely turned our world upside down. There's a little bit of a cult culture at SUV where it was part of your identity. A lot of close friends, you know, that worked there that you worked with for a very long time. But for me, you know, after the FDIC took over, not many people know this, but every employee at SUV got an email that essentially told you no longer work for SUV. You can work for the FDIC for 30 days. After that, good luck. And that's what I had going into the weekend. sorry. With that, we actually had my son's 4-year birthday that next day. So me and my wife kind of put a brave face on, had family over and had a good time, and then kind of figured out, okay, what do I want to do next? I wanted to find as big of a lifeboat as possible for me and my colleagues to find a good home to be able to continue to work, do the work that we love. I met up with two of my colleagues, Jake Mosley and Ted Wilson, who are now the co-heads with me at Stifel today. We came up with kind of a short list of banks that we thought could be a good fit for us. And then over the preceding kind of couple weeks, we went and kind of explored those options. We ended up meeting with the CEO of Stifel, learned that one, they were very interested in our team, had a long track record of successful acquisitions, and had a really nice platform for us to build off. They were experienced in venture lending and venture banking, but they weren't so big that we couldn't have a big impact. And so we decided to move there. After that, we were able to bring over a team of about 30 folks from our prior teams and kind of get cranking. And I will say that now we're about 9 months in. I do feel incredibly fortunate that we were able to find a new home that's incredibly supportive and allows us to kind of build this more or less kind of from scratch and do it the way that we think is right. And so now we have a really great team. We have a lot of autonomy to kind of build this. And there's a lot of great energy around the group.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great journey. And I'm pretty sure any of us racing speedboats against armed guards, we'd probably all be in the soft camp with you there, Matt. And endlessly curious and aggressively helpful. Definitely hit the nail on the head from what I know. So love all the setup. And maybe to the point of Stifel, set a little bit of the stage for our audience about Stifel generally, if they're not aware, and your team's role at the venture bank, and obviously tied to this show, how those early and growth stage efforts align to, as we think about the digital industrial, fit into all of that narrative, if we could.
Yeah. So so I'd say that Stifel Financial, and most people, you know, hadn't kind of heard of Stifel before. So Stifel's been around for over 100 years, but I'd say it really got interesting in the past kind of 25 years. And what they did is kind of undertook a series of 20 plus acquisitions to build out kind of three business units, which is a middle market investment bank, a private wealth management practice, and the commercial bank, which is where I sit. Stifel currently has about 8,000 employees, is publicly traded, about a $7 billion market cap. But the commercial bank, where I think is where I sit, been around since 2007. And, you know, our goal is pretty simple. You know, we want to be there for the entire life cycle of a venture-backed company. And we want to come in and get there, you know, when you're a seed Series A company, and again, provide aggressively, be aggressively helpful to companies at that stage to help with their chances of being successful. And then we hope that as you grow, we get to bring in other parts of the bank. So, you know, you found a company, you need a bank, you need some advice, you need some capital to grow, some debt capital. We'll help provide all that to you as you scale. As you look to have an exit or go public, we have an investment bank that is incredibly experienced and has great sector knowledge that can, you know, essentially take you and run that for you. And then we also have a wealth management practice that can help you personally get prepared for those exits or help your teams kind of get prepared for them. And then the cycle happens again. You know, you end up becoming an investor or starting another company. And I can't tell you how many times, either from a success or a failure, that I've worked with repeat investors, repeat entrepreneurs, that we do it all over again. So we're trying to kind of do all things for that community and really help you navigate that life cycle. For, as we know, kind of venture-backed companies are just quite unique. You know, most businesses are not raising millions of dollars and then spending that over several years and taking a while to get to profitability while they're focusing on growth and innovation.
Absolutely. And to do it with folks who really do understand these sectors that a lot of our focus and some of our discussion will be on. It's an added bonus. So glad to have the platform. And maybe so, kicking us off here, first Heavy Hitters podcast of the year, and you are the perfect guest to help us kick off the year to take stock of what we can expect to see in the next 12 months ahead from a banking purview. And so across not only call it digital industrial innovation, but also the venture market broadly, given your banking purview, we're kicking off 2024, where I'd like to get out your crystal ball and tell us where you think what's coming at us in 24. You've got some predicting on one side, strong year for the economy and the stock market with interest rates cuts coming and fueling public markets and making it easier for companies to get funded. And then you got others who may be more cautious, seeing 2024 more tepid and slow growth weighing on labor markets, corporate margins, et cetera. So all that buildup, what's your outlook and how do you see that playing into the venture market after, in my opinion, I think it's backed by the data, pretty brutal 2023 for deal making if you're just looking at PitchBook, NVCA Monitor, deals and dollars down across the board. And maybe tack on to that macro outlook, again, given the audience of digital industrial sectors for this show, how does that fold into some of the venture activity for some of these legacy industries? Would love your thoughts.
Yeah, so it is a really interesting time. And I think that you are correct. 2023 was a brutal year from, you know, a venture funding perspective, even for venture capital funds to raise, and as well as from kind of an exit IPO. And those are all kind of our indicators, or they're all correlated with each other. And so, you know, I'd say let's focus on maybe just a little bit on 2023, a couple notes there that will kind of lead into, I'd say, 2024. You know, in 2023, you know, I felt like there was a couple things happening. One, I think it was bad, but I do think there was more rounds that happened than were publicly announced. So what we started to see, which is really, really interesting and unique, was more down rounds, flat rounds, things like that, or even new lead investors coming in and doing rounds like that, which historically has been pretty taboo to do. It was not something that investors would, you know, you'd have the existing cap table that would essentially have their existing ownership be cut. And it wasn't something that happened very often, but you started to see that. And what that meant, though, is that those rounds weren't really announced. So they were kind of more quietly done. But even with that, I think it was still a pretty bad fundraising year. The other thing that happened is, you know, in 2021, 2022, there was a lot of capital raised at incredibly high valuations, especially in the growth stage. And most of those companies took the advice of try to push out raising as long as you could. So they cut their burn. They pushed out that raise. And so they didn't even come to market looking for capital because they just kind of were a little bit into kind of hibernation mode or trying to make it last as long as possible. I think some of the bad news, and this is what I think you'll see in 2024, is I think you will see consolidation or more consolidation. I think some of those companies are not going to be able to cut themselves into that appropriate valuation where you know, you have companies with very low revenue amounts doing having billion dollar valuations, that I think you are going to see some of those companies get bought or consolidate kind of into others because they will need to come to market for investment in 2024. And so I do think in 2024, you will see more consolidation of companies. And I think a lot of the activity, especially in the growth stage, and I think a lot of the activity that you'll see and that we have been seeing already is actually a pretty robust kind of Series A market, an early stage market where you're able to set new valuations with new entrepreneurs. And some of those entrepreneurs will be spinning out of those growth stage companies and cycling back into the market. So I think you're going to have a lot of talent that's going to be like the problems that are being solved, especially, and we'll get into this, especially in the, you know, digital industrial space, are still really big and really relevant. Nothing has changed there. And so you're going to get really great entrepreneurs who are coming and trying to kind of solve those problems. And I do think, you know, similar to 2023, there's still a lot of dry powder, VC dry powder that was raised. You know, you had record fundraising years for venture investors in 2020, 2021. And there's a lot of money that's sitting on the sidelines. And that money does need to be deployed. And so I think that you will start to see, I predict, you know, 2024 will be a better year than 2023. It'll be returning to kind of what the investment cycles look like in, you know, 2018, 2019, not the peaks of kind of during the pandemic and COVID, but, you know, I think you'll start to see that capital be deployed, though slower. So we had gotten to a point where investors were deploying cap their funds in a 1 to 2 year cycle and then going back to market, where now I think it'll return to normal of more of a 3 to 5 year investing cycle, so that even there's a lot of dry powder, I think it'll be deployed slower. So you'll see kind of less on that side. More on the digital industrial side, like I mentioned before, there's still, you know, big challenges with supply chain. There is still a big focus on bringing manufacturing back to the US. And so from a macro perspective, there is still plenty of opportunity for innovation and investment across those groups. And I don't think there's clear winners across large categories, agriculture, construction, manufacturing. And so there's still a lot of ability to innovate there. And I'm continuing to see, more and more interesting companies be funded there in those sectors. And I do think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion on AI. AI is obviously kind of a buzzword that you hear a lot, but I think this AI applied in the physical world will continue to be an interesting place for investors and have incredible alpha for the companies that get it right.
Yeah, and I think you're spot on. I think even the last couple of quarters, Matt, we've had some back and forth on some of these new green shoot companies that are starting up, because the supply chain issues aren't getting any better. And a lot of that's the talent that's recycling out of some of those companies that are maybe going through recalibration or had to find an exit opportunity. So I think lots of optimism for 2024 in the sectors. And maybe to put a cap on this, you know, Bill Gurley, right? Famous quote, play the game on the field. In your opinion, net, everything we talked about, kind of a healthy recalibration to not doing 1 year fund deployment cycles and valuations with unexpectations you can't make. Is this a good thing to get us back to a kind of a more normalized playing field, in your opinion?
Yeah. So I kind of describe it as like a forest fire, like in that when you get an overgrowth in the forest, there's too much growth. You can't have the smaller plants grow. What ends up happening is a forest fire happens, it kind of clears it all out, and then you see flowers start to bloom again. And I think that this kind of reset is healthy for the ecosystem, because there's only a finite amount of top talent that needs to be deployed in the right places. And the capital, you know, again, if you want, you know, long-term healthy returns for LPs, which is what makes the ecosystem work, you know, you need to have a certain number of exits and it can only, you know, handle a certain size and certain valuations. Mm-hmm. And so I think resetting it is a good thing for innovation. And I'm optimistic.
Right on. Well, as a rural East Texas guy that used to do some controlled burns himself, I think it's a perfect analogy. So I'm going to run with that one, Matt. I'll give you some credit when I do. Well, maybe I'll push us forward here and let's talk more about that evolution of the digital industrial ecosystem. We could broadly define it however we want, but it's a space you've been very active and immersed in for over a decade easily. And a lot's changed even over the last 2 to 3 years that we were mostly talking about over the last couple of minutes. But in somewhat of a then and now type setup, you know, what's the evolution you've seen across this landscape in terms of types of companies and founders you've seen enter these legacy sectors? Who are the groups that are funding these startups? the nature of exits, which liquidity, obviously a big part of venture is having those liquidity events, et cetera, however you want to take it. Clearly, in my opinion, more thematic attention. You called out some earlier of reshoring and other things going on, startup formation we talked about, and funding that's rushing into these sectors than ever before. And I think the data supports that. So net, what's changed in your opinion over the last decade to draw all of this venture activity in the digital industrial ecosystem?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different questions or kind of focus areas around founders, macro, as well as kind of investors. I would say, you know, from a founder's perspective, you know, the thing that's happened, I think, that's pushed a lot of founders into the space is the wanting to have an impact or to have their life's work be something that's, you know, bigger than just an exit, but something that helps kind of change the world or, you know, improve kind of America's position in the global infrastructure. Like, I think that, you know, the founders that are coming into kind of these industrial tech spaces want to solve big, hard problems. And there's nothing against kind of the next, you know, marketing software or something like that, but like that there is a group of founders that essentially get incredibly passionate and excited about doing that. Frankly, I think you're in the same camp as me. Like, I also get very excited about that. Those are the companies that I want to support and be around as well. And I think what we've seen from a technology perspective with just kind of the advancements in, you know, it kind of hinges on, like I mentioned before, this advancements in sensors and camera technologies that made them very cheap but very powerful, the advancements in edge computing and the advancements in AI that allowed you to now, you know, take the things that have been, you know, transformative, right? The way that you work, you know, the way that we consume content, and put that in the farm or, you know, on a manufacturing floor, and the ability to kind of take those same kind of technologies, put them in the physical world. It is really hard. It is really hard to make these businesses successful. And we'll talk about it later, but there's all these points of failure that as you scale that make it incredibly challenging to do these businesses. But one, they can be incredibly sticky. And once you get in, they're huge TAM, huge parts of the market.
Big moats. But, absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. Huge moats once you get in there, but they are really hard. But I think founders are often motivated to take on that challenge, who want to experience that and have a bigger impact. I think the thing that's been actually really great for funds like yourself is there's been a whole group of investors that have been brought up that are focusing on you know, this sector in general. And these businesses are often a little bit different. They take a little bit longer, they have different challenges. They need different guidance and advice. And so what's happened is there's actually a really healthy ecosystem right now with seed, you know, early and growth stage investors that have kind of bubbled up over the past 5 to 7 years. And it's kind of continued to evolve and get even better, where you have specialists who are focused on either industrial tech or mobility or even dual use technologies or climate. You know, you have a lot of capital as well as a lot of focus and a lot of experienced investors who are really making this kind of a healthy ecosystem for a life cycle of a business. And when I first started focusing on this space, there actually was this pretty bad valley of death for a lot of deep tech companies, because they would raise a Series A and a Series B round and finally get to product market fit. And it took a lot of capital to get their product out because, you know, they had to build hardware and they had to build everything from scratch. And they would then go to raise their kind of Series C round, and they had not scaled enough to get a growth stage investor, but they were too high a valuation for a Series A investor. And I saw a lot of great companies end up exiting and getting sold or being able to having to raise these very obscure kind of rounds to continue to survive. And, you know, what ended up happening is there was the SPACs kind of filled that for a little bit. The growth stage investors came down market and were doing that, but then those all went away. But the good news in the in-between, what ended up happening is a lot of these deep tech funds ended up raising growth stage vehicles within them, their own fund structures, or new growth stage investors popped up. And so I do feel like right now there's a really great ecosystem of investors who have that focus, which I think is really, really good for for that sector and can help these companies continue to kind of expand and grow. The other thing I would say that that's been a really real positive, which does de-risk a lot of these investments, is early on, you know, 5-7 years ago, you had to build everything from scratch. So it took like $20-30 million to get a robot, you know, out in, you know, to see if it works and if anybody wants it. And now I think you're able to leverage a lot of developer tools, a lot of off-the-shelf hardware, that you don't have to build everything from scratch. So you can get these kind of Series A seed stage companies getting out and getting their product, earning revenue earlier, which does, you know, require less capital and de-risk that, you know, if you end up, what would end up happening is if you spent $20-30 million on a product, you got it out and it didn't work, or it wasn't what the customer really wanted, then, you know, you were kind of out of luck. And now I feel like you're able to leverage a lot of leverage a lot of existing technology, so you don't have to build it all from scratch. I will say the other part that has been interesting is the dual use side. So you've been seeing more and more of this American dynamism or kind of defense tech as a source of capital. And that, you know, if you flash back like decades ago, that used to be kind of the way that technology evolved, is, you know, your initial market you would go after would be kind of selling to, you know, to the Defense Department. And then you would be able to get grants and get early revenue to help fund your innovation. And you also were able to kind of test it and make sure it worked. And then you use that to kind of then commercialize in the public sector. And so there's been a little bit of a throwback to that. And you see a lot more companies that are looking to leverage that type of capital to grow. So, you know, I think those have all been really positive, I'd say, momentum. I would say the not negative, but the thing that has happened is there's actually a bunch of industrial tech companies that are hitting scale. And you're actually seeing these companies go from $1 million in revenue in a pilot contract to, okay, great, it works. I would like, you know, 1,000 robots, or I would like to scale. And as I mentioned earlier, that's really hard. And you're starting to see, you know, a lot of companies were kind of struggling with unit economics and, you know, gross margins and things like that, that when you're early in development aren't as important, and kind of it looks great on a pitch deck that you're going to improve your margins to 70% from zero. But now it's actually like rubber's meeting the road, and companies need to prove that out. And I think, you know, one thing that's missing, and, you know, you mentioned the report with Eclipse, but that I think we need to do a better job of as a community is kind of helping companies understand what are the right metrics, what is baseline. And there's a ton of info on SaaS companies, and there's the magic number and the rule of 40 and all these different metrics. But for industrial tech or deep tech, there's not as much of that. And I think we're reaching that point where companies really need that, and they need to kind of understand where they need to be to scale. I also think that will help attract growth stage investors, where you have this product market fit, you have a technology that works, and then capital can kind of flow into it.
Yeah, very aligned with all of that. And it's a perfect segue, because like you mentioned, that kind of growth capital gap you mentioned earlier, even to the point of, you know, how venture banking can support the hardware as a service model. Okay, great. Now we've got all the specialization. We got more attention. I know I'm even taking calls from tier one generalist VCs who are now appointing GPs to become the supply chain focal. So I think it's great. We're getting more attention, more funders. But I think what you just called out, Matt, let's go deeper in that, is critical. It's now let's really understand the metrics that you have to build in the business from the beginning to really have a healthy shot at scaling and leveraging something that's going to take on an industrial challenge per se. And so maybe building this up, leveraging your expertise and insights, you know, you've advised and assessed thousands of companies in this heavy industries across transportation, aerospace, energy, ag, industrials, all the things we've talked about. And so from a capitalization strategy, let's talk about what is different to build and scale business, you know, frontier tech, tough tech, industrial tech. And though not always the case, sometimes there often is a business model that requires a combination of software plus hardware. You mentioned the report again. I'll make sure I sublink it in the notes so everyone can find it. But bringing it all home back to what you really started off on, What have you found as those tactical keys to success in growing and successfully exiting a VC-backed company that has a hardware plus software business model, that they do have to get those unit economics to start thinking about certain metrics a different way than maybe call it a pure enterprise SaaS company? Would love to dive in.
For sure. Yeah. So I think one area that I've spent a lot of time on is kind of this hardware as a service business model. And we saw this emerge, you know, 5-7 years ago as companies, as a way that companies were going to go to market as opposed to just an outright hardware sale with some type of kind of maintenance on the end. And, you know, the pros of going a hardware as a service model are very clear. You know, it's one, you have a much more predictable recurring revenue source. You can get higher margins kind of over time. Often you're able to kind of own your hardware longer. So if you want to swap it out or you're still iterating on it, you're able to kind of control that. And then you also control the data that's coming off those, off that hardware to kind of make the entire system better. And then it's also an easier sales cycle. So when you're going into these businesses that might be slow adopters of tech, if you're able to kind of offer, you know, more of a monthly or, you know, pay-per-use kind of model, you're able to get in and have them try it and see if it works. And then be able to kind of scale that way. The problem is, and this is especially true with kind of industrial tech companies, is, you know, it's not as easy to scale those like there's capital as well as like implementation and staffing kind of challenges with going from one customer to kind of 1,000 customers, or one unit, one robot to 1,000 robots. And that is often the way these sales cycles happen, where you're selling to a very large corporation. They do a pilot with 5 to 10 sites potentially. And then if it works, and often, you know, it's significantly better than their existing solution, they say, great, we'd like you to go from 5 to 10,000 kind of, you know, sites. And you know, that is, if you were an enterprise software company, everyone's high-fiving and popping the champagne, and you spin up some AWS instances and you're off running. And yeah, of course, there's like, you know, customer support and things that you need to kind of work with. But like you have an 80% margin company, you get paid annually in advance, and you need no capital to kind of go work that, you know. And in deep tech or industrial tech, you know, you often have a hardware component, and there's often a cost for doing that. There's often implementation, install, you have to get on site, you have to train people. There's a lot that goes into kind of that scaling motion. The part that I spend a lot of time in is on the capital side. So, you know, you're now foregoing that upfront payment that you usually would cover not only the cost of your hardware, but your margin immediately. And so maybe you had a 60, 90 day kind of working capital cycle, but it was pretty short. Whereas now, you know, that working capital cycle can be a year, 2 years, because you are now foregoing that upfront payment and getting paid monthly, you know, from that. And, you know, when we look at companies that scale, and we have a product, as I mentioned, that does fill this debt gap and can step in and kind of help companies finance this so they don't have to be using just solely equity. But you do see when companies show you a plan where they scale to from 5 million in ARR to 30 million in ARR, you know, their debt load can spike quite high if you're only selling kind of on a monthly basis. You know, you can see a company that has, you know, 20, 30 million of debt in order to kind of get to there. And there's a cost for that. And also, as you've seen interest rates go up, you know, when interest rates were lower, one, equity was less expensive, as well as debt was less expensive. You know, putting a bunch of debt in the books and you could pass it on to your customers, it wasn't as meaningful. Now that interest rates for the loans that we do are, you know, in the high single digits or, you know, low double digits, interest rates, it is a bit more costly to do that. And so one of the things we've been advising companies on is, you know, trying to get your customers and your suppliers to help you cover some of this burden of financing in this as a service model. So where before it was like, hey, just charge monthly, get in the door, get going, and you'll be able to finance that. Now it's, you know, if you can, you know, maybe it slows your growth a little bit, but if you can get annual payments in advance and help get some of it kind of covered by your customers, that's going to make you have to take a less of a debt load and maybe use those monthly, you know, silver bullets kind of in situations where you need to win a deal and finance those to keep kind of some of the debt balance or the equity balance kind of down. And so I think that when I talk about kind of financing and for hardware as a service businesses, you know, you kind of have four places you can fund, you know, that you can help kind of solve your working capital. You have your customers, you know, which you can flex on them to help get payments in advance and things like that. You have lenders like Stifel. You have suppliers, right? So putting pressure on them to give you the best terms, and then you have equity. And you're going to have to use a portion of those at all times. And as you get stronger and stronger as a business, you're going to want to be pushing on all of those to make sure that you're getting the best terms. Because when you're selling your first unit, you're still a Series A early stage company, you're going to have less power influence over those entities than when you're a, you know, 1,000 robot company, or when you've hit significant scale. So continuing to push on kind of all of those. I'd say the other part that we've kind of noticed is just the margins, you know, and some of it has to do with, you know, how many people in the loop that you have to have with your product. So, you know, baking in that you have to kind of really understand the psychology or the practices of the workplace that you're entering, and to be able to kind of assimilate and get in there in a way that's going to require kind of the least manual intervention within. And so we, you know, if you look at which are the companies that scaled up really, really fast and early, were the ones that were probably the lower tech. They were kind of sensors and cameras deployed in a lot of different varieties and leveraged that data for, you know, not as much autonomy and things like that. Those are much harder. And so with the autonomous solutions and things like that, I think you need to be, you know, if you have to have more humans in the loop, then that is a big hit to your margins. And then also if you have to train folks and have them change the way they work, that can be really difficult. So, you know, I think as technologists, folks can get really enamored with creating the next really cool, really hard technology. But at the end of the day, if it's not what the customer wants, or it doesn't fit within their culture or within their practices, then it's not going to get adopted, and then it just is kind of a waste.
Yeah, well, it's to say the least, you could probably have a masterclass on this for an hour, Matt. It's unfair to try to package it all up, but if anything, I hope the audience is listening. For these types of plays, there does have to be a lot of sophisticated thinking around your capitalization strategy, around how you're going to think about your metrics and your unit economics. And I know I've lived it. It was only one part of the ingredient amongst others for Rethink Robotics, but brilliant technology. But man, when you're deploying a lot of robots and supply chain and inventory and cash conversion, ARAP, all of those things, it can really hurt the business, and you have to have thoughtful partners. And so I'm going to just leave it to say, reach out to Matt if you really want to get smart on the topic. So, and with that, maybe thinking about time here, I always do want to bring it back at some point to those founders out there actually mixing it up, and maybe those that are thinking about, you know, reaching out to you for a banking relationship at Stifel Venture Bank. Give them some keys to success, maybe something early to get right, or something that is a common challenge you'd head off and help them avoid when they enter the discussion.
Yeah, I think that for founders working with Stifel, or the best, you know, we'll open a bank account and we can provide lending and do all those type of things. But the way you're going to get the most out of it is try to engage and actually think of it as a true partnership and a relationship. And, you know, I think understand that you know, we are trying to help and that there is a lot of access as well as opportunity that you can gain from really engaging and kind of thinking about it as a partnership, as in the same way you would think about an investor that you would want to bring onto your cap table.
Absolutely.
And the more you do that, you know, the more you get out of it. There's companies I work with that, you know, have incredible experiences and get access to all types of things, and it's literally just because they engaged and they wanted to put the time in. And I do get some like skeptical, there's like some skepticism, especially when you're used to like never wanting to interact with your banker ever, and wanting to just, you know, all your banking relationship is you go to an ATM or you do a wire online. Like that's kind of all you have. That's what is expected. And there is some skepticism when we're trying to engage in a deeper way. And there's some skepticism of why you're doing this, right? I'm a tiny company. At my previous bank, I had to call a 1-800 number, and now you want to spend significant amount of time on me. You're willing to put millions of dollars of early capital to work. You know, what's going on here? And I have to explain our business model, which is, you know, we're going to lose money on this relationship for a long time. And when you're successful, there's going to be lots of banking things that we're going to do together and lots of opportunities, and we'll do just fine. But, you know, in the early days, we're going to just give. And, you know, hopefully we have such advocacy with that when you're a big company, you know, you're like, no, Matt was there when we were early and just starting, and we're going to continue to kind of work with him at that point. And so that's what we're looking to do. So I'd say just look to engage and kind of, you know, think of it more as a partnership. And you'll get a whole lot out of the relationship, whether it's at Stifel or other technology focused banks.
Well, I can, from the groups that are sector focused investors alongside us, we all know how critical these relationships are. So hearing it directly from you hopefully emphasizes the message we're already preaching here. But all right, Matt, well, the final section we always love to call little quick hitters. If you're ready for some rapid fire Q&A, we'll jump in.
Let's do it.
All right. Number one thing you're looking for when you're evaluating taking on a digital industrial innovator.
Yeah, I think for us, the biggest thing that we're looking for is, are you looking to build something big? So, you know, we only work with kind of that high growth, high IP type of company. And so no matter what your stage is, if that's your ambition, then we're going to be able to provide something unique to you.
Right on. Well, what is one resource, could be a book, podcast, blog, whatever you'd recommend to the audience to follow in this ecosystem?
Yeah. So, outside of heavy hitters, of course, I would say, you know, I'm a little different. So the way I learn and the way I kind of, think about problems is I like to, focus on kind of people or things kind of outside of the sector and then apply it to kind of my business. So I'm a big
sure.
fan of like a Tim Ferriss podcast and, you know, thinking about world-class leaders in other areas. And then I often look to kind of apply that back to my life or both from a personal professional perspective.
That's great. Yeah, we could a lot of outside applications coming into these sectors. I've seen it make huge differences. So love that one. One person who could be on the show and help us wave the flag in support of this ecosystem.
Yeah, so you've had a lot of great investors, a lot of great companies, a lot of great corporates. One person that could be interesting is Zach Kimball, who's the founder of Hardfin, who's looking
to do. Yeah, I know Zach. That's great.
Yeah, so he's looking to do kind of contract management software for hardware as a service companies, but he does have an immense amount of data on how these companies scale and metrics. And so I'd say, you know, that would be an interesting purview to get kind of real data on what a scale look like, what a successful scale look like for these type of companies.
Awesome. And then finally, best way for folks to reach out to you after the show, Matt.
Yeah, it's mtrotter@stifel.com, or you can find me on Twitter or LinkedIn. But yeah, that's would love to connect with any folks that want to learn more and see how we can help.
Awesome. Well, we got lots of tailwinds behind our sectors. We do have a fresh calendar year, or at least I flipped the page on the calendar. So we're in a new 2024 and very optimistic. And I'm glad to have great allies with you. And so thanks for coming on and sharing some of the lessons learned. And I look forward to finding more to work with you this year.
Thanks, Ty. I appreciate the partnership.